On this edition of Celebrating Science, John Grant on the Mars rovers and the planetary mysteries uncovered. Brought to you by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, an independent, nonprofit scientific research and education outreach organization, home to a growing cluster of international scientists who contemplate and calculate new ideas about the very essence of space, time, matter, and information. Perimeter Institute also offers a wide array of educational outreach activities for students, teachers, and members of the general public in order to share the joys of scientific research, discovery, and innovation. In this presentation, Mission to Mars, Still Roving on the Red Planet, John Grant shares findings from the Mars rovers and discusses how scientists plan to push the limits of future robots in space. Dr. Grant joined the Smithsonian Institute as a geologist at the Center for Earth and Planetary Studies in 2000. He helped pick the landing sites and works on the day-to-day operations of the Spirit and Opportunity rovers.
Period is June 10th, 2003. A Delta II rocket built by Boeing, the first stage made of six solid rocket boosters. Once lit, there's no stopping the boosters. The $400 million payload atop, the first of two rovers, will either launch or it will be destroyed. At 70 miles above the Earth, the rocket is going supersonic, traveling at 17,000 miles an hour. In the nose cone, the rover is sustaining 8 Gs. The second stage kicks in over Africa, and the third stage gives the spacecraft the final push toward Mars. This ship carries the dreams of an entirely new generation of explorers. Unlike Armstrong, Aldrin, and 10 other astronauts, one of them a geologist who set foot on the moon, and unlike Columbus, Magellan, and other navigators who set foot on new shores, today's explorers are working by remote control, from behind computer screens. They're not as well known as their predecessors, but tonight you're going to meet one of them, Dr. John Grant. Dr. Grant earned his bachelor degree from the State University of New York College at Plattsburgh and received his master's in geology at the University of Rhode Island and his doctorate in geology at Brown University. He joined the Smithsonian in the fall of 2000 as a geologist at the Center for Earth and Planetary Studies at the National Air and Space Museum. Dr. Grant is a key member of the science team behind the entire Mars mission. He not only led the group that picked the landing sites, he continues to work day-to-day operations of both Mars rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, a 90-day mission that is stretched into a two-year odyssey. His eyes on Mars include a special stereoscopic camera, a special imager with links to Waterloo Region. Pictures are captured by special CCDs designed by DALSA Corporation here in Waterloo Region. Tonight, we'd like to pay tribute to a guest in our audience who made this happen. He is Savas Chamberlain, the CEO of DALSA Corporation, and I'll ask him to step up briefly. Thank Thank you. And that's the camera on the top of the rover. Now, Dr. John Grant is pushing technology even further. He is co-investigator on HiRISE, a high-resolution camera that is currently on its way to Mars. In addition, he is leading the development of a groundbreaking penetrating radar for possible deployment as he conducts fundamental research related to the history of geologic processes on Earth and Mars. His numerous articles have been published in the likes of Science, Geology, and the Journal of Geophysical Research. But John will tell you that the most important publishing in his life is something he came across as a young boy. That's when he read Ray Bradbury's The Martian Chronicles and was inspired to lead a life in science. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to Canada, Dr. John Grant.
Well, thank you. It's very endearing and thrilling to see so many people in the audience. After 2 years, sometimes it seems like folks are going to lose interest and not going to want to pay attention anymore. And this convinces us that there are still people out there watching what we're doing. Now, what I'd like to do tonight is run through a couple of different aspects of the mission. I'm going to start with a brief overview of what the rovers are all about, why we sent them to the places that we did, and then I'm really going to dive into some of the results that we've gotten from the rovers, starting with the Spirit rover, which is in a place called Gusev Crater, and then moving on to talk about Meridiani Planum, where the second rover, the Opportunity rover, is located. Now, you're going to see a couple of pictures or images throughout this talk that look kind of like this one that has a nice little rover painted into them. While the image that you see here, as fantastic as it is, a sunset over Gusev Crater on Mars, is real and was taken from a place called Longhorn on the west spur of the Columbia Hills in Gusev Crater. The artist was responsible for putting in the rover. So when you see those sorts of things, no one's there, there isn't another rover there that's taking the image alongside it. It's got a little bit of artistic license involved. I'll also point out that a number of the images that I'm going to be showing you, which are fabulous in terms of their quality, are also sometimes not true color. So you're going to see some things here that look blue or look orange sometimes. That's because the cameras actually look at light in different wavelengths to try to say something about their composition. So when you see things that look an odd color, by and large, if I forget to point it out, that's because it might be a false color image. So keep that in mind as well. Okay, well, what are we talking about here? Here is sort of an artist drawing of the Mars Exploration Rover. It's about the size of a golf cart. If you look at the top there where the little eyes are that has a local connection here to Waterloo, that's about a meter and a quarter, meter and a half off the surface. There's a whole series of cameras on this thing that allow us to really characterize the surface as we drive along and identify interesting targets that we can then go up and really do some in situ targeted analysis with what we call our arm or IDD. Now, I'll start down here with the arm. It's got 5 degrees of freedom. So it's got a shoulder joint, it's got an elbow joint, it's got a wrist joint, and it's about the length of a human arm. So we can take these instruments that are out on the end here and place them against rocks and get very detailed measurements. There's 4 instruments out here. One is called a microscopic imager. It allows us to basically use a geologist hand lens on the surface of another planet and get detailed information about the texture of the rocks or the sand or whatever it is that we're looking at a particular time. There's 2 spectrometers, an alpha particle X-ray and a Mossbauer. And what these basically do is tell us information about the composition of the material. One emphasizes the iron mineralogy of the materials that we're looking at, and the other looks at the elemental abundances. And through those 2 sorts of things, we can piece together, is this something that's a lava that cooled off way back in Mars history, or is it a rock that has another origin that may say something more detailed about the role of water on Mars at some point in the past. Now, there's also something called the RAT, or rock abrasion tool. That's down here, and because we're on the surface of another planet, looking at rocks that have been sitting there for something on order of 3.5 to maybe 4 billion years old, they oftentimes have crud on the surface of them. And so if we want to get that detailed information about the composition, we need to basically scrape that away, and what that RAT does is it grinds down through it. Now, these 4 instruments were designed for a 90-day mission, along with everything else that you see here on this. We've been going for 2 years now, and there's aspects of the payload, although they're still functioning, don't quite do what they used to do. So for example, this Mossbauer spectrometer uses a radioactive source. It decays with a particular half-life. What took us maybe 12 hours to get data on a rock before is now taking sometimes 2 days, something that we never anticipated and we can't do anything about. Down here with the RAT, our grinding heads for the one that are in Gusev Crater have been completely worn away. We've ground through so many rocks that they're gone. But there's some interesting features associated with this instrument that we hadn't anticipated. There's some brushes that go along with the grinding heads that swept away the material that we were grinding. Well, they're still there. And so we can still place that against the rocks and get most of the crud out of the way. And it's this sort of, well, let's figure out how to do things as we go along approach that's allowed us to do the same sort of science with these instruments today that we really were doing back 2 years ago when we landed. Now that's the sort of in situ science down here. We've also got this mast that's got a series of cameras. It's a pan cam camera. It's basically got 20/20 vision, so the way you see things in this room is the way we see things on Mars. It's, as I mentioned before, got a number of filters to look at different wavelengths of light. We've also got what we call navigational cameras. These are of slightly reduced resolution, so that it allows us a bigger field of view and allows us to get bigger images back down on the surface that help us to plan where we're going to drive in a given day. There's also something called a mini test. It's an infrared spectrometer that basically senses the thermal properties of rocks over different wavelengths, again, to get information about its composition. And so what we do on a typical series of days, or sols as we call them on Mars, is we use our mast instruments up here on the PMA, as it's called, to look around us, find interesting targets. Then we use our mobility, the six wheels, to drive over to those targets, and then we place our tools down here to get information about composition and try to evaluate the geology of the surface. Now, I can't possibly compete with the video that you just saw. Actually, as I was watching it, it reminded me that I think it's Disney and Lockheed Martin just came out with a new IMAX movie that I happened to see last week. And it's almost like being there, I gotta tell you, it's pretty amazing. But I did get to go to both launches, and I can tell you that your heart is pounding because this thing is literally sitting on the top of a controlled bomb, and you've put your heart and soul into it over a period of time. You don't wanna see something happen at this very early stage. I do remember for the night launch of MIR-B, as we called it then, Opportunity Now, that we could actually see it in the night sky long enough that when the solid rocket boosters first started to peel off, there was a kind of a flash of light associated with that. And I remember thinking to myself, and others confided in me later the same thing, did it just blow up? No, it didn't, everything was fine, but you're just sitting there waiting for something to happen, hoping it didn't, and it didn't. Okay, but until the thing lands on Mars, you really don't know what's gonna happen. It's sort of surreal. You don't wanna say, well, I'm gonna count on this, because if you look back over the past 30 years or so, 40 years, and you look at the number of spacecraft that have been sent to Mars, there's been an awful lot that through circumstances largely beyond anyone's control, sometime because of engineering flaws that were unforeseen, they don't survive, they don't last. And so we know that when we send these things to Mars, there's a fairly good probability that in fact they may not do what we ask them to do, they may not survive to perform the mission that we hope that they would. So here we are out there on New Year's Day in Pasadena, 2 or 3 days before the first rover set down on January 3rd on the West Coast, just after midnight on the East Coast of January 4th. And we're going through things. You can see my bald head up there doing press conferences. And in the back of your mind, you're going, well, if the worst thing that comes out of this, I got out of Washington and I got to see a free Rose Bowl parade out in Pasadena, not too bad. But the geekiness came out in me and we landed. And I got to tell you, I wasn't the only one doing that. We were very happy about the survival, in this case, of the Spirit rover. It was really a very thrilling night. Now, I get a lot of questions about, how do you do this? I mean, where are you sitting? What are you doing over the course of a day, or sol, again, as I mentioned, for Mars, that allows you to plan what the rovers were doing? Well, it's evolved over time. For the first 3 months, actually 4.5 or 5 months, we actually lived in these two rooms, literally, out in Pasadena at JPL. I moved away from our families, moved into apartments out there, and what we would do is effectively go back and forth between 2 or 3 floors in a building, building 264 for those of you that have ever been at JPL, and we sit down here, and we look at images that are coming back from Mars, and we decide in this science assessment room what we want to do the next day. And of course, there's a lot of us, and we're all scientists, so we all want to do something different. And then we move upstairs and we sit in this very formal room called the SOWG, which stands for Science Operations Working Group, and hash it out. And that's one of my jobs, is I sit here as one of the chairs of this. There's six of us, three on each rover that are rotating through. Sometimes I work opportunity, sometimes I work spirit, and bring the group to consensus. Sometimes that's a lot easier than herding cats. Sometimes it's a lot harder than herding cats. But it turns out that there was an aspect of this mission that nobody anticipated that kind of became the, you know, let's go have a talk over here, a little sidebar. And that was the ice cream chest. Before we landed, there was a comment made, what are you going to do for us if it works? I wasn't party to this. I was not in the room. I actually wasn't even at JPL. This is the rumor. And the answer, the rumor goes, is, well, if you land safely, I'll buy you all ice cream. And sure enough, about 3 days into the mission, they bought ice cream. We said, this is really good. I mean, it was Ben and Jerry. I shouldn't be talking, you know. It was good ice cream. I swear to God, we all gained about 20 pounds, but that's where an awful lot of the business of running the mission got done. They took it away from us in mid-February, I remember, because we were eating over $500 worth of ice cream a day. And we forced them to bring it back. And they did, and we actually had to pay for it ourselves. So, okay, well, what do we do now? I'm back at the Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. I don't go out to JPL that often anymore. I was out there last month for a few days, but that was the first time in quite a while. The way we do this now is through remote operations. We know each other very well. It's by and large the same people working on the mission now that were when we were all there and in person. And so we know each other's personalities, we know each other's voices. It's much less important to be right there in the room with those people. And so here's one of those sets of workstations that I showed you from the science assessment room. Those were loaned out all over the country. I can look at the data as it comes in. I can plan new sequences and observations as I plan uplink for a coming day. And then up here on this screen, I can actually see into that SOWG room and talk to people that are there and do this entire process remotely. Now, the one hitch is we still do it on West Coast time. So for example, next week when I'm doing Spirit, we won't start on the East Coast until 4 p.m. and I'll end up going till about 10 p.m. But that's an awful lot better than early on when we were living on Mars time, which means that we were living according to a Mars day, which is about 40 minutes longer than an Earth day. So every day, the day started about 40 minutes longer. Sometimes we were getting up in the middle of the night, sometimes in the middle of the day. Really, things got kind of confusing after a while. So I'm not complaining about working until 10 o'clock at night, as long as I can do it from the comfort and quiet of my own office back in Washington. Okay, so that's kind of an overview of the mission. That's kind of an overview of what I have done in it in terms of operations or how I do things, I should say. Now let's talk about the missions themselves. What you're looking at here is a map of Mars. This is showing the topography or the landscape. Areas that are shaded in blue are relatively low elevation. The higher areas are in the warmer colors, reds and orange. There's some large volcanoes here, the Tharsis volcanoes that are shown in white. The landing sites of previous missions are shown in red, Viking Lander 1, VL1, VL2, Viking Lander 2, and Mars Pathfinder. Our two rovers are here in Meridiani Planum, Opportunity, and Gusev Crater, Spirit. And these two landing sites were selected for two different reasons. We didn't want to put all our science eggs in one basket, so to speak. So Meridiani Planum was actually selected because, in fact, what we had seen from orbit when we looked at the surface before we got there was the occurrence of a mineral, hematite. Hematite is a semi-precious stone. Some of you may even have it on as jewelry right here tonight. It's oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes associated with water. And so we are very interested because there was a unique, in the sense of its expanse and amount, occurrence of hematite in this region. And so based on chemical evidence, we decided to place one lander here because our goals are essentially to determine the aqueous, or water, climate and geologic history of two places on Mars. So we want to know, what role did water have in the geologic evolution of this site? 12 hours and 20 minutes away on the other side of Mars, here in Gusev Crater, we picked the surface as a landing site for a different reason. As you'll see in a minute, this large crater has a very large valley flowing into it. It's called Ma Deim Vallis. And you look at that and you have to say, if this valley was formed by flowing water, then water had to have gone into Gusev Crater sometime. And if it went into the crater, in all likelihood, it carried sediments and deposited those sediments in the floor of the crater. And so we wanted to go and try to address these issues on the top of the slide at Gusev Crater based on morphologic reasons or evidence, based on the idea that we could go and actually sample those sediments that had been laid down by running water. Okay, well, here's Gusev Crater up close. Again, you're seeing the sort of topography or landscape colored with high areas in red and low areas in blue. The red dot denotes where we ended up landing on the surface. Gusev Crater, I'm used to giving this talk in the United States. It's about the size of Connecticut. Okay, so it's big. It's about 150, 155 kilometers across. And here's Mahadim Vallis down here flowing into the crater. So you get this sense that not only did the valley come in, but the crater's partially filled with material. And we went there hoping that we could sample that material and say something about the aqueous history of Mars. Now, what you're going to see down here in the left corner of the slide is nowhere near as dramatic as what you saw during the introduction, but what it is a reconstruction based on the actual motions of the spacecraft as it came through the Martian atmosphere just up until the point of landing on the surface of the plains in Gusev Crater. So here we are flying down. This is a three-body system. The rover's down here. This is the back shell, and this is the parachute, obviously, here. And they're doing this sort of thing as they go down through the surface, or through the atmosphere. You can see them kind of rocking back and forth, and the wind's blowing them. And so what we've got at the very end is a series of rockets that actually not only slow the spacecraft just before it hits the surface, because we really don't want that bug on the windshield thing, but it also can sense the motion laterally and cancel it out a little bit so that we're not flying into the surface almost like a skipping stone on water. So we want to land with almost no lateral motion and very little vertical motion. And in fact, as we got down near the surface, and you're going to see just how quickly this thing actually approached the surface, it's literally falling out of the sky. We inflate the airbags, boom, rockets fire, tethers cut, and this thing bounces to a stop. Now, there are other orbital assets, or spacecraft, we call them, around Mars, and they're able to take pictures before and afterwards. This is taken by the Mars Orbiter Camera on a spacecraft that's been at Mars since 1997, the Mars Global Surveyor. And comparing before and after pictures of the floor of Gusev Crater, we actually see that this dark mark right here wasn't there before. That's the first bounce. Second bounce, third bounce, four bounce, then we rolled. That white thing that you see is actually the lander on the surface of Mars. There's the parachute and back shell up there, those middle and top pieces of what I showed you before. So we actually were able to see from space where we landed. And when we stood up and looked around, here we are at Columbia Memorial Station. At first glance, it looks kind of like we hoped it would. Relatively flat, barren plains, kind of thing that you might expect if you landed on a dry lake bed. But if you start to look closely, there's lots of big rocks around. And lakes aren't the places necessarily, unless there's lots of glaciers that are, you know, carrying rocks out on ice, where you see big coarse fragments. You tend to see a lot more fine-grained material. And so very quickly, as we started to look at this surface, we realized that we weren't probably going to be able to sample the very material that we had hoped to. That in fact, there's lava plains that post-date that channel and the water that it carried flowing into this crater and have buried those materials. We did see these tantalizing hills off in the distance, but in fact, as we looked at those, recognized that this was a 90-day mission, recognized that these rovers were only supposed to go about 600 meters over their lifetime, and these things are almost 4 kilometers, 3 kilometers away. So, you know, the idea of getting there wasn't really occurring to us at that time. What could we do? Well, if we go back here for just a second, Bonneville Crater there is located just, you know, hundreds of kilometers. That's about 210 meters across, so just a few hundred meters away from where we landed, and it's a hole where a meteorite hit and punched through this material, and we hoped that it had actually punched through deeply enough so we would be able to access those sediments that we were so interested in, maybe below the lava that we had actually landed on, the broken up lava. Well, we drove up to the rim of Bonneville Crater. Here we are sitting on the rim. You can see sort of a panoramic view there with a blow up down here. And all we see is this sort of rubble-strewn surface with a lot of sort of wind-blown drift in between and these tantalizing hills off in the distance, and no bedrock. Not only did we not punch down through the lava to the sediments underneath, but we didn't even punch down through, I'm sorry, did the meteorite not punch down through? It didn't even punch down through the lava. So we were left sort of scratching our heads saying, wait a minute, we're here to figure out the aqueous and geologic history, but this isn't really what we came for. And at that point, we started to get a sense, we're now almost, I think, 2.5 months into the mission, that, hey, these things might last a little longer than we think. And so those hills became our next target. In fact, this one right here, Husband Hill, is the thing we set our sights on first. Now, I'll point out one last thing on this slide. When we drove up to the crater rim, there on the far side was this glint. Now, we don't expect to see anything on Mars that we didn't bring with us, and if we did, then we got a lot of questions to answer. But in fact, when we looked at this, it's the heat shield that's actually ejected off the spacecraft just after it gets through the upper atmosphere and basically beat us down to the surface and crashed against the side of this crater. We were able to take some very high-resolution images of this and see that it's actually the crumpled remains of the heat shield. Okay, so we kind of loaded up the car and headed off towards the hills here. Here's where we landed, drove up to the rim of Bonneville, and then all the way across these Gusev Plains towards the Columbia Hills. It took us, 150, 160, something on the order of 6 months to get there. It took us a long time. And every day we didn't really know whether the rover was going to quit or not. But we finally got there, and this is what we were met with as we started to scale up what's called the West Spur here. And if you remember from my first slide, the Longhorn outcrop. Now, when we got there, it was actually the dead of winter. We landed during the summertime on Mars because this is a solar-powered mission. We need that sunlight to charge our batteries. We never anticipated lasting into the wintertime. We never anticipated that, in fact, as the sun gets lower and lower in the sky during the winter, just like it does here in Waterloo, that, in fact, we're going to have trouble charging the batteries. But the good news was that while the sun's getting lower, the atmosphere is actually getting clearer. The dust storm season is long over. And so here we are, actually being able to see the rim of Gusev Crater in the far distance, and this area that is sort of in the mid-distance called the delta. Whether or not it's actually a delta, no one has any idea. But it's about where Maudim Vallis, that big valley, drains into Gusev Crater. Truly a fantastic landscape, but on another planet. Okay, so as winter set in and we're climbing up the side of this hill, the rover is literally getting to the point where, if we're not careful, it's going to die because it's not going to get enough power to operate through the course of a day. So we developed this idea, and I don't know where the name came from, but they were called lily pads. And what we did is we generated very detailed slope maps. We would image the surface in front of us. We would figure out what surfaces were in the southern hemisphere here, what surfaces were tilted towards the south, not good because that's away from the sun, and what surfaces, blue, were tilted towards the sun, towards the north. Good, because then we're tilting towards the sun, we're going to get more power. And so what we would do is we would stop at a very interesting rock. We finally started to see bedrock when we got up into the hills. We finally started to see the very rocks that we landed in order to see, not the sediments washed in from Maudim Vallis, but rocks, in fact, that have a long history of alteration associated probably with groundwater percolating through this area. We would sit, we would grind into the rock before the bits on the rat wore out, we would brush the rock, we would do all sorts of work, and then we would pick up and literally scoot over to the next blue area and do the thing all over again. And so very, very slowly over the course of the winter, what we did is wend our way along the north-facing slopes of Husband Hill. And you'll see that about Sol 400, we made a direct turn to the right and headed up the hill. That's when we started to get into the springtime months. Power started to come back, and we were able to ascend the rest of the way up the hill. The red line shows you this sort of circuitous route that we took. We actually almost got stuck here for a little while in a sand drift. And we got all the way up to here, and we started to say, well, what should we do? Should we go up to Summit 1? Should we go up to Summit 2? And I show this slide because it gives you some idea of how we plan things out. There's different options almost always for everything that we do. And so there have to be choices made. Now, in this case, we ended up going to both Summit 2 and Summit 1 as a result of interesting things that we saw in both places. But we do this, for example, when we're sitting at this point and trying to assess where we're going to go and how we're going to get there in the coming months. This is what the side of Husband Hill looks like. Fantastic outcrops of dipping red bedrock. The kind of thing, as I mentioned before, that we had only dreamed about seeing after we kind of came to on the surface of the plains and saw this basaltic regolith. These rocks have been extensively altered by probably groundwater. If we look, we can see that they have a clastic or granular texture. We can see in some places where there's actual possible cross-bedding, whether that's associated with past windblown deposits that were then cemented, or perhaps even water. We haven't figured out for sure yet. We continue to examine this possibility. But this outcrop, Methuselah, is one of many that we study. And again, this is one of those images where the tracks in the image are real, but the rover being put in there is not. We decided that we needed to keep going up the hill and find out, could we piece this puzzle of what all these outcrops were together to get some coherent story about Mars? Now, I described how we made it through the first winter by sort of getting on these north-facing slopes. But the other thing that was starting to catch up with us, especially in Gusev Crater with Spirit, was all this dust that was falling out of the atmosphere during the wintertime. Part of it was falling on the solar panels and cutting down our ability to recharge the batteries. And so you can see in the top here, what it as you go through the steps here, what at about Sol 400 and I think it's 14, our calibration target looked like, rather dirty. And then by about 427, 428, suddenly was very clean again. And one of the things that we noticed at about the same time, if you look at the lower portion of this, are the occurrence of these fantastic dust devils, these vortices literally swirling across the surface here. And you can see the track that was left behind as that one went by, one of hundreds that we've imaged. Now, we don't necessarily know or personally think that it was a dust devil that cleared the dust off the solar panels. But in fact, in association with a lot of these dust devils passing, there were gusts of air. We know that because one day we turned around and looked with the cameras, of course, and saw that our tracks were almost gone. Something had blown sediment across the tracks. And lo and behold, it blew all the material off the deck of the rover. Before, after. Voila, new rover. Complete with that new rover smell. On up the hill we went. We finally ascended to the summit of Husband Hill. Here's this fantastic scene that we see. We're looking off, in this case, to the east-northeast. There's an enormous dust devil there in the distance. Again, one of hundreds that occur during the spring and mostly summer months, at least in this area on Mars. You see this windswept plain. If I show it to you in color, you can see, this is a little bit lower resolution view, that there's this rubble that's probably ejected material from other meteorites that hit nearby and threw debris up on top of the hill. But there's also these areas where you can see sort of lighter color material kind of capping the surface. We don't know yet what that is. This gets back to this outcrop that we saw. There's lots of different kinds of rock compositions and textures that we've seen. We do know that Husband Hill has seen a very complicated history geologically in terms of its evolution, but we're not quite sure yet what that was. Was this something associated with an old impact? Was this something that was associated with old volcanic activity? Or is there some other process that might have contributed to the formation of these hills? Now, what you're looking at here, believe it or not, is a blow-up view of one of those orbital shots down onto Husband Hill. And that little black dot that you see there is actually the rover on the surface right at the top of Husband Hill. And I show this for a couple of reasons. One, I think it's cool. And two, we then drove off to the right, then down the hill, and headed over to this area here, this dark blob that we call El Dorado. It's a dune field. And when we look at Mars, and we look at all the sand, windblown sands that we see from orbit, they tend to be, or not all of them, but many of the deposits tend to look very dark like that. Yet most of the deposits that we saw on Gusev Crater were relatively light toned. And so we wanted to go to this and see what it looked like. But we also had a longer term goal in mind. If you think of that previous picture, we were sitting right up here at the very crest of Husband Hill where the red dot is. And if I look to the south from the top of the hill, I see this very interesting area known as Home Plate. The yellow dot's where we are today. What we wanted to do is drive off towards this really intriguing alternating sort of light and dark feature, which we think represents some sort of layering, some sort of stratigraphy in the rocks. But we wanted to also go to El Dorado, which is sort of over the edge of the hill there, right down on the surface. And so off we went down the south side of the hill, mapping the geology. Don't worry about what this slide says. I only show it because there's lots of colors on it. Why are there lots of colors? Because there's lots of different rocks. It gets back to my point that this is a very complicated geologic setting. We haven't figured out what it is yet. As we got down to the surface, or the base, I should say, of Husband Hill, and we got to El Dorado, here is this fantastic dune field, this windswept surface sand dunes and ripples all being sort of jumbled about, and then a view off across the Gusev Plains to the rim of the crater in the distance. To me, this is one of the most stunning images or sets of images that we've collected during the course of the mission. Really something that looks familiar, at the same time it looks a little bit alien. Kind of makes you think about what you're looking at. Okay, at the very top of this image, called Lorry Ridge, L-O-R-R-E, is the very southernmost edge of that El Dorado dune field that I just showed you in the previous slide. And here's our old friend, home plate, down here. And just out of the slide towards the north is the bulk of Husband Hill that we came down. So we're heading south, we've gone past El Dorado, and we're following this sort of circuitous route. And in fact, right now, actually, this was done yesterday, right now we're sitting right about there, something on order of about 140 meters to go, that's the distance between there, to get to home plate. Now that's not our ultimate goal. We really are very interested in this because we think it's a big part of the puzzle in terms of how this area evolved geologically. But winter is starting to come on again, and we're starting to have to think about these north-facing slopes. Now someone asked me before the talk about the volcanic history and volcanism that has been occurring, eruptions from volcanoes. One of the things, we haven't seen any volcanoes directly, but we know from where we landed on the surface of Gusev that there's these basaltic plains, these lava rocks that have been broken up by impact. Well, one of the things that we think we see here, if you follow along where my finger is something called a flow front, the edge of a lava flow as it kind of came around the corner and lapped up here. And so we don't know the relationship between home plate and this feature, Mitchell Tree Ridge and up through Lorry Ridge, and whether or not, in fact, this is even a flow front. But we do know, because just last week we took this image close up with our little microscopic imager, that some of these rocks have lots of bubbles in them. These are called vesicles, and they tell you something about how much in the way of volatiles or gases and other sorts of things there were in a lava when it erupted. And this says there were a lot of them. So we're very interested in understanding, because it turns out that this volcanic story might not be as, I won't say boring, as uninteresting as we thought it was when we first landed, because I think this tells us something very fundamental about the conditions early on in Martian history. You can see as I've gone through this that there's kind of weird names, like some of them, home plate, Gong Gong. Okay. Actually, this is in celebration of Chinese New Year, which was just this past Sunday. And so we've had a whole series of names related to that, and we do that periodically. We had some names in honor of Thomas Jefferson, you can go on and on. We actually had a lot of names in honor of ice cream that, quite frankly, did come out after they took it away from us. Okay, so you see where our near-term goal is with Spirit. Here's our longer-term goal. Here is a perspective view down to the east. This is Husband Hill. We came up here, wound our way along, sat up on top of the hill, drove down the side. Here's that dark area, El Dorado, headed off this way. We're sitting right about there now, and here's home plate. Where do we go after that? Remember I said that winter is setting in. Let me show this in a little bit different perspective. I'm going to paint on the slopes, and blue is going to be not good in this case, and red is going to be north-facing or very good. So what we want to do is get someplace where we could tilt these solar panels to the north again and survive another Martian winter. You can look at this and see home plate's probably not the place. McCool Hill, MH, seems to have a lot of north-facing slopes. This is something that we call the Southwest Hills, and believe it or not, PL stands for Promised Land. I won't go there. That's a long-term place that we hope to get. But I think, and this hasn't happened yet, so I can't say I know, what we'll probably do is after we get to home plate, we're going to be there probably 2 to 3 weeks, and then head over to McCool Hill, and literally winter over on McCool Hill. Okay, now this is a transition to the opportunity, the Meridiani side of the planet. And what I'm showing you here is some of the other data that we collect. A lot of this is geared towards geology, and I'm emphasizing that because that's what I do. But we've done a lot of astronomical kinds of observations too. This is an eclipse of the sun by one of the two moons of Mars, Phobos. It's got kind of a potato shape, and you can actually see it zipping right in front of the sun as it goes by. When we take these kinds of images, it really improves our knowledge about the orbits of these bodies and how things are working in the local environment of Mars, which helps us then again in terms of navigating the spacecraft to the planet and getting it to land where he wants to, and I think it's a cool image, so I showed it. This is another cool image. That's you. That's the Earth rising. This is at Meridiani Planum. And the other thing that pops in over here in the top left as the Earth goes by right there, that's Jupiter. And those are clouds on Mars in the very early morning, so you can wave it yourself and we'll take the picture. Okay, on to the other side of the planet, literally 12 hours and 20 minutes away. Meridiani Planum is totally different than Gusev Crater, not only in terms of what we found on the surface when we got there, but in terms of what we thought we might see before we landed. This, quite frankly, is one of the flattest geologic surfaces known anywhere in the solar system. The engineers loved us when we said we wanted to land here. No big rocks, very few big hazards like holes in the ground related to meteorite craters. And so they wanted to land here, and we wanted it because, as I said before, there's this mineral that we think might have been related to water called hematite. And if you look in the inset up here in the top right, the various colors that you see painted on there are the relative abundances of where we think this mineral might occur. Reds and yellows are more, greens and blues are less. And so we put this ellipse in the flattest part that we could find where it was still completely covering an area that we suspected had some of this hematite that we could go and sample. Now, I won't go through the video of Opportunity coming through the atmosphere like I did with Spirit, but you can actually see in this after image taken from space looking down, the blast marks on the surface from those rockets before they fired off and landed over here behind me, the parachute and the back shell. And if you looked closely, and I could point them out, well, actually you can't see in this particular image, we actually bounced across the surface towards the top of the slide and rolled into a crater. How lucky was that? How lucky was that? Because at Gusev, where it wasn't until we got to the Husband Hill area that we saw our first outcrop, the rover basically stood up, looked around, and there was outcrop right in front of us. I mean, the night that these images came down after the successful landing of Opportunity, people were just ecstatic. One, because there was outcrop. Outcrop is like, you know, it's a book to geologists. We know that we can read the record in this and piece together, at least over the time period represented by these rocks, what was occurring in this location at that time. And when we looked closely, we could see even at this initial scale that these rocks looked like they were layered. They looked like sedimentary rocks that would record a history of processes, perhaps, but not necessarily, non-volcanic, maybe even, dare we even dream, related to water. Well, one of the very first things that we did, oh, I gotta give you some perspective here. There was lots of talk about, my God, look at this cliff in front of us. It quickly became known as the Great Curb. The wheels here are not especially large, and you can see the outcrop for scale. But nonetheless, it's outcrop. This is pay dirt. This is gold for geologists. Okay, so we started to look around. The white areas that you see here are the outcrop rocks themselves. And what you see painted on in colors is data from the mini-test. Remember that thermal infrared spectrometer. And what we're seeing here is especially sort of a color-coded image that shows the abundance of hematite on the surface, where we landed, in this crater. The blue areas are, in fact, areas where there's not much hematite locally. The red areas is where there's a lot. And in fact, you look and you notice that these are blobs. That's where the rover, before the airbags deflated, actually rolled back and forth in the crater before it stopped. And so we knew that wherever the airbags associated with the rover had touched, the hematite went away. Why was that? Well, we looked first where the airbags had not touched, and then we looked where they had. And I can tell you the big difference was these wonderful spherules, these are 2, 3, 4 millimeters across, were everywhere on the surface where the airbags hadn't been touched. But they'd been pushed down into the surface, and this fine sand that you see in the background was what dominated where the airbags had landed. These little spherules, that's our hematite. What is it? Where's it coming from? Well, we drove over to the rocks, we took a look, and here they are, weathering out of the rocks. If you look closely, you can see in the background, here's another one. They're all over the place. There's another one. They're weathering out of the rocks. Some people think, I happen to be one of them, that this is a good analog for the kinds of things that you see in certain places on the Earth where groundwater percolates through the rock, and precipitates out particular minerals, in this case hematite, and creates something called concretions. These are what are known locally out in the western part of the United States as Moqui marbles. They're not much different in size, necessarily, some of them are, than what we see here. We really think that these things are actual concretions that were formed in the rock by groundwater, our first hint that water played a role in the formation of these rocks. I should also point out, if it wasn't obvious to those of you that may have been wondering, that these rocks, yeah, they really do look layered. So what's going on here? But wait, there's more. As we looked at the texture here, this is one of those false color images. These are the little spherules. For those of you that may have been heard them referred to as blueberries, you can probably understand now where that term came from. This particular stretch false color image shows them very well, but it also shows that there's almost no hematite in the rock itself, but it's got this really interesting texture, sometimes known informally as chicken scratches. If you see these, they're sort of tabular features up close. They're very similar to what we see in places on the Earth, in this case in Siberia, where crystal molds have been left behind as relatively soluble minerals have been literally dissolved out of the rocks. Concretions, crystal molds, hey, we're talking water here. But wait, there's more. As we looked at the details of the rock, and I'm going to show you a much better image of this later, so if you don't believe me now, I think you'll believe it at the end, for those of you that are sedimentologists in the room. What we call, in the way of crossbeds here, or smiles, almost exclusively relate to deposition in flowing water. We know this from the scale of the features, the dip of the features, their relative occurrence, one compared to another, that these are almost certainly not ripples associated with wind blowing across the surface. These are almost certainly associated with deposition in water. When we look at the grains in the rock, now I'm not talking about the spherules themselves, but I'm talking about the grains. It's uniformly fine grain, but it's very well sorted. So we're seeing a rock here that looks like it was deposited in running water, then looks like it was altered by groundwater, that suggests that this outcropping of material has a long history involving water. We spent an awful lot of time in Eagle Crater investigating, driving around, looking at these rock outcrops before we said, we got to piece the rest of the story together. So we left Eagle Crater, headed out across the plains to a larger crater, Endurance Crater, which is about 150 meters across. And whereas here we could see the great curb in terms of outcrop, here we expected to see something like maybe 10 meters. So we'd get a much bigger picture, much greater chapter of the story in terms of geologic evolution. Now remember earlier I mentioned that this is one of the flattest surfaces, at least that I'm aware of, in the solar system. This gives you an idea of what I mean. We're talking flat, folks. There's not a whole lot out there. So we were able to cruise across the surface and very quickly get over to Endurance Crater. This is obviously someone's placed a rover in here for scale. We drove around the rim first, looked inside the crater from different perspectives. Here's a false color image of these fantastic dune forms on the floor of the crater. In terms of the detail, in terms of the patterns that they create, just fabulous in terms of images to look at. And then we drove in. We picked an area where we thought that the slopes would enable the rover to stay upright, and we headed on down the wall of the crater, sampling as we went, trying to get information about the chemistry, trying to get information about the textures. And you can see as we drove down, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, something like 8 or 10 places as we went down this surface where we drilled into the rock and got chemical information. We also saw areas where there were these really interesting texture that we argued about. Could these be sort of relic mud cracks, the kind of thing that you see literally in your lawn if you're like me and you reseed it and then it rains and you get puddles and they dry up and all the grass seed goes away. But anyway, mud cracks, that's a story for another time. So there's a lot of evidence here that suggests running water played a role in Meridiani. But the clincher really was bringing all this together was the chemistry is very consistent with something called sulfates. Sulfates are something that we see on the Earth in association where bodies of water dry up and leave something behind called evaporites. Okay, now this I know applies towards up here because I grew up where it's, actually I think they probably still use salt on the roads up here. They certainly did in northern New York where I grew up, where you'd get puddles in the springtime, the sun would come up, dry them out, and there'd be white everywhere, where the salt literally was left behind after the puddles dried up. That's kind of what we saw here, except instead of salt, we're seeing sulfate material. Similar process, slightly different chemistry. And so piecing all of this information together, the model that we come up with for Meridiani Planum is one probably like you might see today in places like the Middle East, where there's a lot of sand dunes around. Don't think of an ocean here. We're not talking about a deep sea that necessarily evaporated. We're talking about a windswept sort of dune-covered surface that periodically gets water flushed into it by an infrequent, perhaps, rainstorm. Or maybe the groundwater table rises and floods the surface locally. But regardless of the process, the water has to get there, and then it dries up. And when it dries up, it leaves behind these sulfate-rich minerals. And then as the process repeats itself, and more water comes in and goes away, you dissolve out the crystal molds, you emplace the concretions, the little blueberries, and so on and so on. So here's an area where we think on Mars, probably 3.5, maybe even 4 billion years ago, the conditions, while they certainly wouldn't have been a place where you wanted to go and put your beach towel, were much more habitable in the sense of what we see on Mars today. Mars today is very cold, very barren. This is a place where water existed for some time at the surface. Whether or not there was life there, I have no idea. This mission was really not designed with the kind of instruments to go and test that sort of hypothesis. But we are seeing places, at least one place, where over distances of kilometers, conditions at least seem to have been able to have been in the ballpark of what we'd expect to have necessary if life was to get going. Now, I want to show you a couple slides here that show you just the incredible detail of what these cameras can do. As we drove along the interior wall of Endurance Crater, we got to an area called Burns Cliff. And I'm going to show you a blow-up of just the portion in the red box there and give you some idea of the detail that we can see in these rocks. These cameras are amazing. As I mentioned, I think I mentioned earlier, there's a new IMAX movie. Go see this in 5 stories. It's really amazing. So this is the kind of data that we are able to collect and piece together this geologic record. Now again, for those of you that are sedimentologists in the room, you might look at this and say, I don't see evaporites there. This is actually material that we think was associated with the dunes. These are big sweeping beds associated with windblown sands. Remember I said that this is probably a deposit that was mostly windblown sediments but occasionally got wet and saw the deposition of these other minerals. Okay. To give you another idea of the kind of detailed information, what we've been able to do from the various images that we've collected from different perspectives is generate very, very detailed topography. This is Endurance Crater. It's about 150 meters across. The top or outside of the crater is red. The very deepest part of the crater is blue. And by doing this sort of recreation of the details of the topography, we can actually very much, in very great detail, evaluate not only how the crater probably formed in terms of the details of excavating through this material, but also how it's eroded over time, which gives us more clues in the way of the processes that have shaped this surface over time. Okay, well, finally, after a very long time, we even headed out of Endurance Crater, and we saw an even larger crater a number of kilometers to the south. It's about 700 meters in diameter, so something like 4.5, 5 times larger than Endurance Crater. So we hope to see even a greater section of rocks there. And we headed south towards Victoria Crater. Before we did, we stopped by our heat shield. Again, this is the same thing that you saw on the rim of Bonneville Crater when I was talking about Gusev and Spirit. But this time, we're outside of Endurance Crater, half a planet away, and we saw where the thing actually came in, hit the surface, and bounced. Gives you an idea of what might have happened if things hadn't gone so well with the parachute and airbags. And it actually turned itself inside out when it hit and pancaked and bounced across the surface. All the things that you see in the foreground here are pieces of cork, charred cork, that they use to ablate off the surface as this thing plows through the upper Martian atmosphere. And so we wanted to investigate, mostly for the engineers, how'd this thing do? Obviously it worked, but how well did it work? So we spent some time cruising around, checking out the junk that we brought with us. Now, one of the things, this is an entire color image, but I left most of it just sort of as a black and white, but I left this part colored because somebody noticed up there where that red circle is that something didn't quite look like cork. And so we decided to drive over to it, and here's a rock we called SpongeBob. This is a meteorite. This is an iron nickel meteorite on the surface of Mars. It's about the size of my head. Kind of amazing when you think about it, the things that you stumble across when you're cruising around the surface of Mars. Okay, so here's Endurance Crater. We actually landed somewhere over here in Eagle Crater. Our heat shield is right there at the tip of this arrow, and we broke our trek up to Victoria Crater, way over there on the right side of the screen, into four legs. We've completed three of these, really, even though leg three is not yellow yet. The first one took us about 45 sols, 48 days, something like that, and was sort of marked by its end at a crater that was very degraded, and I won't show you lots of images of, called Vostok. The second leg, which was even longer, but was covered much more quickly, took only 20 sols, a little over 3 weeks, ended in an area, a crater known as Viking, and I will show you an example of that one because it's very fresh and very interesting. This third leg has been a real bear. As you got across from about where this white line is to the right-hand side, the number of and size of windblown drift, ripples, dunes, across the surface increased dramatically from what I showed you over here. And the driving really got tough. And we didn't appreciate how tough it had gotten for a while until after we had cruised through these, I mean, this has got to be, to me, the most desolate looking surface that I've ever seen before, cruising through these Meridiani Plains ripples and dunes. And then one day, after going by Viking Crater, this amazing fresh crater, got stuck. We got stuck. Because what we were doing was we were telling the rover to drive, say, towards the back of the room, and there were no hazards, really. There were just these ripples. And we were going up and over and up and over and going along. And so we would tell the rover to go 200 meters, 100 meters over the course of a day, stop, take its images, and report back. That's how we were able to make leg two in 20 sols. But as we got into leg three and these ripples got bigger and the material within them got finer and finer grained, one day when we told the rover to go something like 100 meters, it went about 40 meters or 50 meters and then got stuck and went 40 or 50 more meters right in place and dug itself in. Okay, now some of you may have heard the term high center. We did not do that with this particular, in this case. The wheels dug in, but we never got down to the point where the rover was bogged down. The rover won't allow itself to do that. I got to tell you that while it seems a little bit cavalier and cowboyish to say we were doing this across the surface of Mars, in fact, there's lots of built-ins to protect us from actually getting stuck and breaking the rover. But nonetheless, this is pretty serious stuff. In fact, we measured over 99% slip backing out of here. It took us forever because we didn't want to just dig ourselves back in. Okay, if we drove 50 meters to get in, go 50 meters to get out. Well, what if all we did was go down deeper? And so it took a long time because every 100 wheel turns, we actually only went one. So it took us a long time. We didn't waste the time. We looked at the dunes. We saw much smaller, in this case, blueberries and spherules than we saw back in Endurance, so we know the rocks are changing, whereas those were 2, 3, 4 millimeters across. These are more like 1 or 2. And we also noticed when we ground into the rocks here, which are much softer than they are at Gusev, which is why the rat still works just fine over on this side of the planet, there's not nearly as many blueberries in here, spherules in here, and what you do see are much smaller. So something's happening to the rocks. The second major hiccup that happened is after we got stuck, we emerged into this area. I should back up here a second and show you where we are, just by context. This is an area called Erebus Crater. It's very degraded, very old crater. We're sitting right where that red dot is. And as we wound our way around here, we got to an outcrop. This was our idea. We were going to go to an outcrop that we called Payson. We got into a kick where we were doing names after Northern Arizona for a while. So Payson is an area out in Arizona. And we also have very creative names like West Ripple Field and East Ripple Field. And we wound our way around the outside of this crater, and we got to one of these things called Outcrop, and we decided we'd stop there for 2 or 3 sols on our way to Payson. Well, we are here, something like 150 sols later, at an outcrop called Olympia. When we got there, we had a problem with the arm on Opportunity. The shoulder joint, actually, as it turns out, had a break of one of the wires in the windings. And so the motor no longer worked the way it used to, but we didn't know that. It took us a long time to figure out what happened. All we knew initially was we told the rover to put the arm out and put the instruments on a rock, and it didn't do it. It stalled. And we tried and tried and tried, and these engineers at JPL are incredible. They are this thing is, you know, over 100 million miles away, and they're troubleshooting it. And they can't go work on it. And they figured it out. And they're able now to reuse the arm, but very, very slowly and very, very carefully, we're recovering from this latest setback, and we're actually completely recovered now. But it turns out we don't want to leave this place that we've been at for so long, because as we looked around us, we saw the most fantastic rocks. Now, this is a false color image. This is not taken by a balloon over the top of the rover. This is actually a self-portrait. These wonderful cameras that were built in part here in Waterloo are looking down on the surface of the rover and then taking very small images, and then we're piecing them together in an incredibly detailed mosaic. And here's this outcrop known as Olympia that we're sitting at. And what we saw as we looked at these in detail are more ripples. Now, maybe you didn't see them in the last slide and you wondered, sure, running water? I think anyone that has gone to the beach or has played in a river, a creek bed, and has seen sand that's been swept along by the current or by the waves has seen the kind of features that we're seeing here. These ripples are almost irrefutable in terms of their existence. And so the evidence that water played a role in this, now remember, we're kilometers away from where we were before. So yeah, we're thinking sand dunes with water in between, but still, a fair amount of water. We're starting to get into a situation here where you've got to say that water existed on the surface of Mars, and it existed for more than a week. Now, whether it was 1 million years or 100 million years, I don't know. But it must have been around for at least a little while. Whether or not it was long enough for life to get going, no one knows. But as you can see, as we've gone through leg one, leg two, and now leg three, 300 sols and counting, eventually, here's our goal here, Victoria Crater, because we want to get more section of rocks. We saw this much at Eagle Crater. We saw almost 7 or 8 meters, maybe 10, at Endurance Crater. We may see 30 or 40 meters when we get down to Victoria. And that's going to help us say something about, was it hundreds or thousands of years, or was it millions of years that these conditions persisted? Because if you start to get into millions of years, you've got to scratch your head and say, all right, this is a place that, at least relative today, was an awful lot more like the Earth than it is now. And then you start asking questions about life and all sorts of other things. Now, I show a sunrise rather than a sunset to say I'm not going to stop there, even though I think I've got like 1 minute left. What I want to do is very, very quickly jump into sort of the next mission on Mars, just to give you a hint of what might be coming. The next mission, which actually goes into orbit around Mars in early March, I think it's March 11th or March 14th. I ought to know the date, but right now I can't think of it. It's called Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. It will not land on the surface. It has a very high-resolution camera and a number of other instruments on board. And I'm involved with the camera called HiRISE. And this is an artist's view of what the orbiter will be doing as it's looking down on the surface. This camera will be able to image things on the surface of Mars that are like this. And so if you think that you need about three things like this to be able to tell that you're looking at a podium, or you're looking at a chair or something like that, we're going to be able to make out things, identify things on the surface of Mars that are probably on order of a meter or even less across. We're going to have incredible information, not only about the local environment, local surface that we've been going along with our rovers, but now we can extrapolate this to much of the planet. And because we can turn this on and off as we go around, we can target what we think are the most interesting places. This launched last August on a very different rocket than what you saw for the Mars Exploration Rovers, but it is on its way to Mars. Geeky science shot here. There's the camera itself. This is actually a telescope. It's got a 50-centimeter diameter mirror on it. Okay, we're talking about something that if I had it in my backyard, I'd be the envy of all my geeky friends. But we're really going to be able to see some fantastic. I actually have a lot of geeky friends. I was going to say I won't make a list. This is sort of what we expect to see. What you're seeing on the left here is a view of the Grand Canyon in Colorado. And this strip that you see is about the width of what we get in our highest resolution views of Mars now. This high-rise image will be much wider than that. It'll cover this entire sort of comparative width. But it'll do a lot better than this resolution and that resolution. It'll actually be able to pick out individual rocks and structure within individual layers that is going to allow us to say something about, is this a rock that was an old windblown sediment deposit? Is this a rock that perhaps was related to past running water? And we can do this around the surface of the planet. And I show you one last picture here that has nothing to do with Mars. This is actually a picture of the moon. This was taken from something like 200, I think I'm right in saying this, look on the website and correct me if I'm not, something like 200 times the distance from the moon as the Earth is to the moon. 200 or 20, I might be getting order of magnitudes here. But anyway, a heck of a long ways away. And you can still see, even at that distance, I think it is 200, the detail here for a global view. Imagine what this thing is going to do when it gets to Mars. And those of us that are involved with it can't wait, because on the one hand, we're going to be dealing with the rovers on a day-to-day basis, planning where they're going to be going. We hope for another year, 2 years, maybe even longer. We don't know if they're going to quit tomorrow, but maybe they won't. And at the same time we're going to be doing that and investigating rocks in Meridiani and Gusev, we're going to be looking down on the surface and picking places and comparing places and understanding something about the overall geologic evolution of Mars in ways that we couldn't do before. So I'll leave you with that sort of tantalizing tidbit of what's coming down the road here, and I thank you very much for your kind attention during this presentation.
What kind of thought was there given into bacteria, microbes, and stuff that came from Earth that is now on Mars, and what that may do to the assumingly pristine environment there?
Yeah, I was actually talking to someone about this just before I came up here. There's actually something in NASA known as the Planetary Protection Office. And there's a lot of thought, quite frankly, that goes into making sure that what we send to Mars isn't going to contaminate Mars with the Earth. Now, that doesn't get into the idea that there's meteorites that have probably gone back and forth between both and that sort of thing. This just says, hey, what's our hardware doing? A couple of points to make here. Various aspects of these missions go through various amounts of sterilization depending on whether or not we expect them to come into contact with the surface. For the heat shield that ablated as it came through the atmosphere, even though it didn't totally burn up the cork, was subjected to very, very high temperatures. So in that case, we really believe very strongly, and tests have shown that we're probably right, that the possibility of contamination associated with the heat shield is very low, similarly with the rovers. Now, where it does become much more of an issue is with this next mission, for example, that they're going to fly, called the Mars Science Laboratory. It's going to launch in 2009. And there's a number of instruments that specifically are geared towards looking at past habitability. Here we looked at, you know, what was the climate, what was the geologic history, what was the aqueous history about? Well, wow, we found that. Now let's go find out if it was habitable. And those instruments that are going to come into contact with the surface have to be especially cleaned, not only for the reason that you described, because we do not want to contaminate Mars, and there are ways to sterilize things. But we also want to make sure that we don't take something all the way from Earth with us, only to rediscover it again when we actually look at rocks on Mars. So an awful lot of thought goes into exactly what you just raised. That's a very good question.
I just wanted to know what temperature ranges the rovers fluctuated through the summers and the winters and, you know, the evenings and mornings.
Sure. Well, one, we don't have a meteorological package, so we don't actually have a thermometer that sticks out. But we do have a number of temperature sensors in different places. And from that, we can kind of extrapolate. Temperatures get down, I think, in the vicinity of the rover interior, we saw temperatures on the order of minus 50 to minus 70 range, typically, C. And we actually saw temperatures in the daytime, in the peak summer, especially in Gusev, over zero, or inferred to be over zero. So quite a temperature range and really cold, but not out of the realm of possibility, at least in these particular areas, that you might see in places on the Earth. Now, having said that, that doesn't mean that Mars is as warm or Earth is colder. Remember that during the winter months with both of these rovers, we sought out actively warmer places and places that got more sunlight. So probably, we hope, weren't representative of the overall thermal environment. Now, one other point I'll make. The thermal cycling that these things are going through, a swing of 50, 60, 70 C every day, is extreme. You know, I grew up in a northern climate. I know what that stuff does to my car and my car battery after a period of time. These rovers have been doing it for 2 years, and they're recharged by the sun. At some point, that's going to catch up with us, and there's going to be a mechanical failure. But we're looking at the wear and tear. We're looking at the way the battery is performing. And yes, something could break on either of these rovers or both tomorrow. I really hope it doesn't. And by looking at the way they're operating, I don't think it will. I mean, having said that, who knows? But they really could go another year or two.
Quick question on periglacial features on Mars. Obviously, what you have talked about here deals with the location of the rovers. And I'm just wondering whether you would like to make some comments on whether any missions are planned to look at permafrost-type features on Mars.
Well, funny you should say that. There's a program called the Scout missions, the first of which will fly to Mars in 2007, and it's called the Phoenix mission. It's being flown or headed by a guy named Peter Smith at the University of Arizona, and it's going to a relatively high northern latitude to an area where we think we see pattern ground, to an area where, from one of the instruments in orbit around Mars, a neutron spectrometer that senses where hydrogen may be coming from the surface, which may be associated with water, through that indirect evidence suggests there may be ground ice there. And so, in fact, this next Phoenix mission is very much geared in a lot of ways towards what you're describing.
Ever since I realized that there was a search for water on Mars, where on earth has all the water gone? Presumably there was quite a bit to have an effect, which you have suggested it has had.
Yeah, well, no one knows for sure. We know some of it, even today, is locked up in the polar caps, especially the northern polar cap, as ice. We suspect strongly and have lots of reasons to believe, for example, from things like the blueberries at Meridiani and the altered rocks that we saw at Gusev, that some of it went into the ground. That this hydrologic system that had been operating for we don't know how long shut down, and a lot of the water was simply lost to the groundwater system. We also know that the environment of Mars today and its atmosphere is such that even today, parts of the atmosphere and some of the water is being stripped off by the solar wind. And so we strongly suspect that a bunch, that's a very technical term, a lot of the water, it's even better, fewer letters, a lot of the water has been lost to space. Your question is an excellent one. I'm laughing at myself, not at your question. But we don't know, fundamentally. We do not know where the water went. And that's one of the big remaining questions, because if a lot of it went into the ground and conditions were quite habitable for a while, which we don't know, but you know, maybe everything that went along with that habitability went down in the ground with it. And so maybe even though the surface of Mars looks pretty dead today, and barren, maybe down below the surface, it's not that way. Maybe, and I'm not talking about lost cities and that sort of thing. I'm talking about, you know, what was Mars like, and could it have life have gotten a foothold in that early system and then moved underground as the water was lost?
I want to come back to your points where you're always discussing the ripples and the sort of topology of the rocks. I used to work for a NASA contractor, and they had made this triangulation scanner that used to give a lot of very detailed three-dimensional maps. And we talked to the Canadian Space Agency and geologists in Canada, and they seemed quite excited about the idea of actually getting three-dimensional maps of the rocks in Mars. And I just wanted to ask you how useful you would interpret that kind of information.
It's very useful because you're only seeing both, because there's a lot of images to show you and I get to pick and choose because it's what I'm most interested in, and also because of time, some of the images that we've taken. But a big part of interpreting those features as ripples has to do with seeing not only one side of the rock, but then seeing another side and then seeing the top. You need to know what that feature looks like in three dimensions, because lots of things can create lines on a surface. But until you know how those lines translate into space in three dimensions, you really can't say something positively about what the feature is that you're looking at. And so we spent a lot of time taking images on one side of a rock, finding rocks that had the features, but also had faces that were multiple orientations, so we could piece these things together. And then we actually did try to put it together in sort of three dimensions to get a clue as to what was going on. So those sorts of data are very important, and we've used them.
I was just wondering how well the planning and forethought into the rovers was. Is there anything now you wish could have been put on, or is really a lot of it already there and you really planned it out well for the rovers?
There's two parts. I mean, you know, hindsight's always 20/20, and you wish you could have brought something with you you didn't. I do that every time I go out in my canoe or something. I mean, people have said, what if we had had a Raman spectrometer? What if we had had a, you know, you fill in the blank here. But I think that in general, the kinds of tools that we have brought with us on this particular mission towards the goals that we wanted to accomplish have been very useful. So while there's always additional stuff we wish we could have brought, I think that the things that were selected really have done a very good job at allowing us to get at what we wanted to here with understanding the climate, geologic, and water history of two places on the planet.
I have a supplemental question. In the drive to reduce the weight of the payload, because the original mock-up was way off scale, did you have to give up any scientific instruments on board to reduce the weight?
No. There's a process that goes back and forth with these missions of you come up with a design, you think it's going to work, and you make an estimate of what its mass is going to be and its volume is going to be, and it always changes. And with spacecraft, because you're never sure how much the cables are going to weigh and never sure how much the clips are going to weigh, the mass almost always goes up. And so they have margin on these things to make sure that you don't push instruments off. But there's this constant give and take between, well, if we increase in mass a little bit more, we might lose part of our solar panels. And if you think back on that now with the dust accumulation, because then it was only going to be a 90-day mission. How much dust can accumulate in 90 days? Well, some. As it turns out now, the ability to sort of beat back down that mass number and preserve those extra solar panels is huge, because it's one of the reasons that we can do a lot of the stuff that we're doing even 2 years into the mission.
You're making a lot of conclusions from the pictures that you're showing, but those pictures have to travel a long way, 900 million miles, you said? So I'm wondering how accurate are those pictures? Are what we see really what we get?
Yes. Actually, the distance changes. So 100 million miles sometimes, 300 million times, 300 million miles other times. You know, we're in different orbits around the sun. The images and the data are as they are sent from Mars. We know that for a couple of reasons. Oftentimes they're retransmitted, both because we have dropouts or because data dropouts. We didn't get a bit back. So I think that's the kind of thing that you're referring to. And we've retransmitted and confirmed the situation, but also because we did a tremendous amount of calibration of these instruments before they were flown on the spacecraft. And so we can compare, for example, views of the calibration target when it's sitting on the surface of Mars. And we know, because we measured here on the Earth what it looks like, how much it has or hasn't changed, or how the cameras are performing. And so we know from those sorts of things that the cameras, in fact, are still performing basically as advertised and as they were when they launched.
You spoke about the difficulty of driving through difficult terrain. And I'm wondering, how do these machines, can they sense and avoid certain obstacles? Or how does that work? Because obviously you can't be operating them with a joystick from Earth.
No, it's anywhere from a two-way light time of about 10 minutes to sometimes 24 minutes. So you'd go over the cliff. There's three basic ways of driving. One is called blind driving, which I described. That's our top speed. We know that between me and the guy with the microphone, that if I go right down the aisle here, there's no hazards. And basically, blind means what it is. We turn off our hazard avoidance and we just go from point A to point B. The other kind of driving that we do that's somewhat similar to that is called VisoDom. And I won't go into the details of what that acronym means, but it basically says that the rover takes a set of images every step it makes, and then it makes another step and takes a set of images and it compares the two. And it sees how much it's moved and how things are moving relative to it. And so as we go around things that are relatively hazardous, we can very, very carefully pick our path and make sure that the rover stays on the path, because if it doesn't, if the images don't match up, it says, I'm not driving anymore. The third kind of driving that we do is called auto navigation. At some point after I get by the guy with the microphone, I think that the aisle looks pretty clear, but maybe somebody's got their foot out. So what I want to do is tell the rover to keep going, but now instead of just turning off its hazard avoidance and going, what it does is it basically, using its hazard avoidance cameras, these little bug-eyed things that I think I was supposed to show here as I went through it, senses rocks on the surface and avoids them. And that's that very slow sort of 10 meter per hour kind of driving that I described. So there's these three modes, and sometimes on any given day, we'll use all three modes. Blind driving is obviously the most efficient because we can go this 2 meters per minute. Auto nav is the least efficient because oftentimes what will happen is, yes, indeed, someone's foot is there. The rover says, nope, not going here. And even though we gave it 2 hours, hoping it would go 10, 20 meters in that 2 hours, after 5 minutes, it said, sorry, not driving anymore. And it just sat there for an hour and 45 minutes. Okay, so that's a very frustrating thing. So sometimes when we plan a drive, the drive will say, how far do you think we're going to go today? And they'll say, well, we're pretty sure we're going to go 30 meters. That's the blind drive. And we could go as much as 60 or 70. That's the additional auto nav. What is truth? Usually somewhere in between. If we say we're going to go 30, we might go 70. Oftentimes it's 40, 45, something like that.
If you lose the ability to direct the rover, yet it can still communicate back to you, will it run autonomously and start picking out targets?
No. But it does, every once in a while, things happen. As recently as last Thursday, I was on Spirit, and Spirit did not complete a drive. They're called dynamic brakes. They're on the steering mechanisms, and it basically controls the motion of the rover. It was a fault that we had seen way, way back in the early stages of the mission, but the rover basically faulted out of its drive. And by that I mean, at the end, what we commonly do is that we finish a drive and we say, where's the Earth? What's the most, actually in this case, not the Earth. Where is the spacecraft going overhead that we're going to radiate our data to that's then going to be transmitted back to the Earth? And we turn for comm. We turn towards where that's going to be. In this particular case, last Thursday, that turn never happened. And so I came in on, actually it was on Wednesday, I came in on Thursday morning, and there was very limited data back. So we really didn't know what the state of the rover was. We recover from that over a period of a sol or two as we get more images down to figure out where we are, what happened, and then move on from it. On an extreme case, on the 18th sol of the mission, way back in January 2004, just before the Opportunity rover landed, there was initially thought to be a glitch with the Deep Space Network. Actually, it wasn't them. There was rain in the area, and we thought that there was an error transmitting commands to the rover and then getting data back down. We didn't hear from the rover. It turned out to be a much more serious problem. It had to do with the amount of data that we were storing on board, not only the amount, but the number of different files that we had that was causing the rover literally to reboot itself constantly. And we almost lost the rover as a result of that. But it goes into something called safe mode. And while it won't start to pick out targets, what it will do is say, all right, I don't know what's going on, but I know I'm supposed to do this. And it will start to do systematic searches through the sky with its antenna and start listening for the Earth, turning towards where it thinks the Earth is, that sort of thing.
This edition of Celebrating Science has been made possible by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics through the support of private and public funding partners, including the Government of Canada and the Government of Ontario. To learn more about the Institute and to enjoy other programs, visit us online at perimeterinstitute.ca.